Tony, can you hear my fan?
No, I don't think so.
That's excellent news.
I can noise cancel your fan.
Yeah, but you noise cancel, that degrades the audio quality. Come on.
You got rabbit ears, Mark.
You all get heavily noise canceled on every episode because you are both in extremely noisy rooms. So I assure you the audio quality will survive.
All right.
And I might not in this house where it's 89 degrees currently and I have no AC. So
can you guys hear my blender? Because I'm making smoothies during this episode.
That's not vital to your health, okay?
If you guys don't mind, I'm going to mow my lawn during this discussion. You can noise cancel that out, right?
Wow.
I have a beagle in the room with us. He could howl at any minute. It's nearly 1 a.m. here, so.
Yeah, there's no way to noise cancel the beagle. If he barks, he's staying in the podcast, but that's fine. We got all kinds of animals running around here.
Okay, he might have very strong opinions on Threads as a film.
Not a kind movie to animals, that's for sure.
No.
I don't remember any burnt dogs, but lots of burnt cats for some reason.
There was a burnt dog in one scene.
Oof. They cover their bases.
Yeah, they sure did. More on that later.
Jesus. Yeah.
I'm so excited. I need to calm down.
That's the spirit. Seth, why aren't you ever this excited?
I get giddy.
It's because of the movies you make him watch.
Yeah, that's true.
I was pretty giddy last time. It was the porn episode.
I just saw that, but I haven't listened to it yet. I'm looking forward to it.
We're going from sex to death.
Hello and welcome to Unwatchables, the film podcast that you can't unhear about the films you can't unsee. I am Mark D'Ottavio.
I'm Seth Troyer.
And today we're going back to the Cold War to look at two of the bleakest films ever made about the realities of nuclear fallout. Those films are 1984's harrowing docu-realistic nightmare Threads and 1986's gut-wrenching animated heartbreaker When the Wind Blows. Time to duck and cover.
I usually make those sounds.
Very good. That's Seth's job. It's because we can't afford a soundboard.
Mm-hmm.
That's fair. I think a soundboard would get in the way anyway.
It would. Too many buttons. Too many buttons.
All right. That lovely Irish voice that you hear is from our special guest today, Sinead.
Hello.
Who is something of a Threads expert and all-around nuclear film enthusiast. We heard from Sinead as she wrote to us after listening to the podcast and was wondering if we were ever going to cover Threads, which we did have plans to do. And so she, it turns out, has her own podcast, and who better to have on to talk about these things?
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here. I'm so, so hyped. This is my favorite film, and I never get to talk about it. I guess with my own podcast, what I kind of got into the habit of doing is taking any film and saying, how can I make this worse? I know I'll come up with a theory about it and I'll make it even worse in context, put lots of really depressing clues in there. So as you can tell, I'm a real big fan of depressing films in general. And the films that we're going to be talking about are the absolute apex of depression, which is why I love them so much.
Oh, my God. We have a podcast for you.
Yeah, we sure do.
Welcome aboard.
Well, it's funny now. When I came across your podcast, I have a thing when I hear a film is technically considered unwatchable. That to me sounds like a challenge. So I've seen some pretty wild things, and your podcast is almost like it's made for me. It was like it was targeted at me almost. So I had to become a part of it somehow.
True. It's going to be a long, bumpy ride, though.
The best rides are.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. And so these are two movies that have a lot in common. And just to start us off, Sinead, I mean, is there something in particular about Threads or about these particular, you know, nuclear fallout movies that got you so interested in them, maybe above other kinds of unwatchable movies?
Yeah, I suppose what I kind of liked about Threads in particular was that it was such a realistic look. There's no hero in Threads. And you see, what I don't like in a film is when a hero kind of comes in, he's got all the information or she's got all the information. They know exactly what they're going to do. And at the end of the film, you know, everything's burnt and there's rubble everywhere. Loads of people are dead. They're like at the very end, but it's okay. We'll survive and we'll rebuild society. And what I liked about Threads is that, no, we're not rebuilding society. All of the useful people are dead. All that's left is the sort of the rabble, and humanity will be extinct in a couple of days. And that's going to be that. That's what I liked about it. You know, I like a good depressing gut punch of a film, and I like a realistic film.
I like a film where most of the population gets wiped out. That's usually what I'm looking for, you know.
But you know, this is kind of what I liked about it, was that it was just, these were ordinary people, and they're only about as useful as the society that they're living in at the time. They're not very adaptable, which is the reality of most people, I think. And I mean, I said earlier that all the useful people are going to be wiped out in most disaster times. I mean, the useful people, you're talking the rescue workers, the doctors, the medical professionals, all of those people are on the front line. So they are usually the first to die. You know, not to get too bleak about it, but that's a more realistic look, I think. And it's just the people who kind of hang back and try to work on their own survival. Those are the ones that persist, but maybe not for the best.
Yeah, this is no Roland Emmerich movie.
Yeah. And I was super excited. We always love a continuity, a thread going through the two films that we do. And there is such an interesting like contrast to these two movies. This seems to be a meditation on nuclear fallout in the most macro, like widespread sort of way. And then in our second half, we will talk about When the Wind Blows, which is zooming in to just a couple and just following them the entire film and what it's like for them. So I really appreciated that. These are a really visceral and interesting way of getting into that headspace, I think.
Yeah, they're very complementary because, like you said, they are diametrically opposed as far as one being a kind of panoramic view and one being very intimate. And usually disaster movies try to split the difference between that. And like I brought up Roland Emmerich, and I always think about 2012 in particular, because there's always, you know, like a scientist who's got to like save his family. He's got to get his kids. He's got to reconcile with his wife he just got a divorce from.
He's sexy. He's hot. He's got a cigarette in his mouth.
And even at the very end of that movie, the whole planet gets wiped out, but him and his estranged wife and kids make it onto the Ark, the spaceship that gets to go out and start a new life. And so it's still somehow supposed to be a happy ending, even though civilization and humanity has been wiped out. But hey, this one guy survived, so everything is good.
Yeah, you see, that's the huge problem. It's like everybody's dead. Society has been sent back to the Stone Age. But John Cusack's daughter doesn't wet the bed anymore, and she can continue wearing her fancy hats. Hooray for Hollywood, I guess.
Yeah, that's uplifting.
Oh, God.
So, yeah, I want to put out a little historical context here, because these movies are very much of the Cold War, which, I mean, covers such a long span of time. I mean, roughly from the end of World War II in 1945 to the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. So that's a long span within there, with a lot of different dynamics and eras that we've gone through. And I think that we can't really talk about Threads without at least mentioning The War Game from 1966, which was a very different part of the Cold War than when Threads came out. I mean, it was roughly 20 years after the start of the Cold War and almost exactly 20 years before Threads came out. So we do have this movie that is very similar in that it takes this kind of faux documentary news program kind of look at what a nuclear attack and the fallout would look like. But it's a little more specifically linked to like the Cuban Missile Crisis in 62. And you can even tell in the movie that it kind of involves US fighting in China, or they're fighting China in Vietnam and the Soviets are occupying Berlin. It's a very like 60s kind of perspective. And what do you think about the War Game, which is very similar, but also very shrunk down even compared to Threads, because it's like 45 minutes long. It's like a little appetizer.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the War Games' whole reason for being was because with the threat of kind of the nuclear missiles, I think a lot of people, especially kind of working class people, I'm going to be using that word a lot, actually, in the next couple of, as we're talking about threads, I'm going to use the term working class quite a bit, was that they were trying to kind of impress on the populace how serious nuclear weapons are. Because the people who were kind of living in memory of World War II had a very kind of, everybody's going to pull up their britches and we'll just get on with it, even if we are bombed to hell and back. And I think there was kind of a thing that the populace, just the general populace, they didn't realize how serious this was. So they weren't taking it seriously. And this film was made in an effort to get them to take it very seriously and also to affect the way that people voted a lot of the time, you know, because all of this history, I mean, that's kind of lost on some people, you know, the just kind of the regular, again, working class people. I think they were voting in favor of people that would guarantee them jobs, guarantee them some sort of social security, and kind of weren't thinking about the worldwide effect of the way their votes were going. So I do think, like, the BBC, because it's kind of a general channel, its money does sometimes, it gets pushed into more educational material for the good of the country, more so than like a commercial network would be. And I think that's why that film was made. And they tried to make it as depressing as they could with the limited resources that they could, because they really wanted to make sure people understood how serious a situation this could be if Britain got involved in the Cold War.
Yeah, and that's another thing that makes it so similar to Threads, is there is this kind of advocacy kind of purpose behind it, where it's coming right out and talking to you and saying, this is what would happen, these are the different variables that would be, and how people would prepare, and these are the specific consequences. And I think it's all the more terrifying because at the time, and really even now, we don't have to be in the Cold War to be talking about, you know, the threat of nuclear weapons, but this seemed like something that was not a hypothetical. This was a real dire warning. This is something that had happened in other places and was just as horrific as it was depicted here. And this is my first time watching the War Game in preparation for this. I just threw it on because I figured that this was something that might come up. And boy, it is no holds barred once they depict the blast happening. I mean, it's about as gruesome as almost anything that you see in Threads, which I found very, impressive and kind of shocking for the time period.
There's a little bit of a cultural context here. Would you guys be at all familiar with the work of Ken Loach?
No.
Yeah, he made films like Kes. He made Kathy Comes Home.
Oh, I love Kes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the writer of Threads, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Himself and Ken Loach worked on a couple of different projects.
Oh, Kes will make you cry in a whole other way.
Absolutely, yes.
Beautiful hawk friend.
Yes. And also incredibly grim working class surroundings. But that was kind of Ken Loach's, that was his specialty. And it was very popular at the time to kind of have a kitchen sink approach to social issues. The first film, Kathy Comes Home, that Ken Loach made, was about homelessness, because it was a huge crisis. And he had to, again, try to impress on the British public in general what a big crisis this was. And I think a lot of the War Games film beats, are actually taken from the likes of Ken Loach, or inspired by it. It was just a very effective way of conveying this situation in the most effective way, reaching the most amount of people and reaching the targeted audience that it had. Was, you know, if it was something that was flashy with really great special effects, they probably just would have ignored it as a Hollywood film, you know?
Yeah, and the War Game was so effective that it never ended up getting televised. They were like, oh, buddy, we're not putting this on TV. And it did, you know, they took it around to film festivals. It won the Best Documentary Oscar. But from what I understand, it would never got televised until 85, like before an airing of Threads, actually.
Yeah, they gilded the lily a little bit too much. It was a bit too depressing for people to watch.
Yeah, what a double feature.
Jesus.
Yeah. And, you know, fun fact, actually, the kids that were in it, like who were pretending to be corpses, they were from like the local school around the corner from where they were shooting, and they made the burn effects with cornflakes and powdered gravy. And the kids got the day off from school, so they were delighted.
Yeah, I'm going to go be dead.
So, yeah, but the war game, if that's like, you know, just a taste, Threads is like the whole meal. It pulls it together into this big epic. And at this point, we're in 1984, quite a time later, and we'd already gone through the 70s, which was mostly a time of detente and the tensions being ended in large part with a lot of the things that Nixon did, at least from the U.S. point of view. And then, you know, the 80s come along, Reagan comes along, the Soviet-Afghan war strikes up again. And I feel like this, kind of in the same way the war game was reacting to the Cuban Missile Crisis and how close of a reality that seemed to be, that there were similar things happening in the early 80s. In particular, I was reading about this NATO exercise they did in 1983 that was basically in preparation for a nuclear strike. And it actually put the Soviets on guard, like they were afraid that they were actually going to attack. And some people maintain that may be the closest we've actually ever gotten to nuclear war. And whether that's true or not, I feel like you can see those anxieties come out in Threads and When the Wind Blows. And then just even in the plotting of the movie, which is no longer about like China and Vietnam, but the Soviets in, you know, Iran and the Middle East. So I feel like this was kind of another like clockwork reaction to what was going on culturally.
Absolutely. And I suppose there's another little kind of context in that film is as well, England were kind of coping with the IRA bombings as well. So they were kind of the two bombings that they were used to and that they had experienced before in living memory was incendiary bombs from World War II. And I mean, like, you can go to places in England now and still find like unexploded pieces of bombs in random cow fields and things. And then the nail bombs that the IRA were using at the time. So this was like another set of completely different bombs that they were being exposed to. And I think a lot of people felt very hopeless at the time.
And I'm sure it's no coincidence that the day after the American-made film came out just the year before Threads as kind of like the US version. So clearly this was in the air.
Yeah. But, you know, like I have a, you know, The Day After is quite an effective film itself, but I do have a slight objection just to the kind of the hopeful ending of it. Because if these films were made to try and convince people not to push the button, the important people not to push the button, I think The Day After kind of failed, but Threads went full hog at it.
It's true. I almost wondered towards the end, like for a second, you do think things are wrapping up in a sort of like, oh, you know, you just squint through it for like 10 years, you'll be fine or something. But then it still hammers it home, and we'll get to the very end.
Oh, man, kicks you right in the face.
Well, you know, I think about The Day After, actually, that they have some recognizable character actors. John Lithgow is in it, and Steve Guttenberg. Is it Steve Guttenberg? Yes.
Yeah.
Isn't it? And I think they sort of their presence shifts the film into, oh, this is just a fun piece of entertainment. But with Threads, originally what they were going to do was they were going to try and cast it with the actors from a soap opera called Coronation Street that's been running for many, many years and everybody is super familiar with. So these are the people you see every day on your television screen. For you guys, it's the equivalent of maybe watching like Ross and Rachel from Friends struggling through the nuclear winter.
Oh my God.
Oh boy, I would sure watch Friends if that happened.
I know, me too. But in the end, they couldn't. But it was kind of reflected in their casting. They casted a lot of very unknown actors, but these were kind of, they were actors that looked like people you knew. They looked like people that you hang out with in the pub. Kind of people. And I think that made it more realistic for the people that were watching.
Yeah, there is such a verisimilitude to this movie from the, you know, the fact that you don't recognize anybody who's in it to just the way that it's filmed, especially if we kind of talk just about the first 45 minutes, like the ramp up to the attack actually happening, that there's so much, it kind of shares with the war game that it, part of it is almost like this instructional video documentary where, you know, there's like text that's typing on screen, giving us little facts, and there's voiceover explaining things.
I love the text. It's such an interesting way of just netting the whole thing together. But it never does feel like just a hypothetical exercise or something, which I think could be the danger of throwing in that stuff that almost like takes you out of it being like a narrative film. It has like a documentary feel. I don't know. It lands in this because of its ensemble makeup where, yeah, like you said, there's no hero. We follow various threads and there are various characters that we follow and everything. But that only adds to it feeling like it is it's a real event that we're watching. It somehow lands in this interesting gray zone between fiction and nonfiction and speculation. It's like hypothetical speculation and things like that. I haven't seen a lot of movies that sort of play in this place where there are a lot of like disaster movies that are like, hypothetically, this could happen. But once you start like making it a hero's journey or something like that, or injecting it with some sort of genre feel, that's when it really drags it back to a knowable place that this does not do that. And it adds to the realism. I know I have some friends that saw this, like when they were way too young to see this. I'm not sure. I was wondering if it was this. They said it was this, but I was wondering if it was the other ones. But it doesn't matter. It's like, I think that is what I've heard a lot about these disaster, like nuclear movies, is like kids were seeing them at an early age and it was like this radical, crazy thing. And I mean, imagine watching this as a kid. I would really not know the difference, like, especially since it's quite often framed as like a news documentary or something. I'd be like, Mom, is this happening right now? Where is Sheffield? What is happening?
Well, did you know that this was screened in schools?
Horrifying.
My Lord.
Primary schools, elementary schools. They were shown to kind of kids in the 8 to maybe 14 age range.
Oh my God.
I mean,
God.
I could barely handle it now.
I watched like the opening credits to Halloween 4 when I was like 13 and it ended me for a week. So this would just be the death of me back then. I was such a scaredy cat.
Yeah. Well, maybe the English accents might have helped soften the blow at least a little bit. But no, you see, for the first 4 to 5 minutes of it, it is the kind of thing you'd see in Coronation Street, like if you were tuning in to watch that on a regular basis. And of course, in Ireland, we only had a handful of channels at the time. So we watched all the English soap operas as well. And it was just like, oh, you know, Ruth and Jimmy, they got together. They don't really want to be together, but they're kind of stuck because she's pregnant and he's cheating on her. And that's 45 minutes of them having the domestic drama that then just sort of fades away into the actual point of the film. And I think that's a good way of kind of dipping people's feet into it before it hits them with the gut punch.
It's surprising how long it takes for shit to hit the fan in this movie. And I think that's what's really effective about it. It really ramps up. You almost think that maybe we're going to get out of this without that happening, or maybe it's not going to be so bad.
No.
Yeah, I was really impressed with how the slow burn of the first part of this movie, like the tension got to so unbearable for me, like the longer and longer that it went on. And I was really impressed by just how measured and naturalistic the drama was. It doesn't play like the John Cusack, you know, family getting introduced in 2012. And it's shot in a very impressive way with lots of, you know, close-ups and precise editing and just little vignettes of things that you see. And at the same time, I was impressed that it does do this tightrope walk that Seth was saying, with having all of these interjections of like text and voiceover. And somehow that doesn't end up like distancing us from the action or you know, lessening its impact, because everything is just so well measured out. They are going about their regular lives and they're just consumed with their own, you know, mundane, very personal concerns, while they're just kind of helplessly watching in the background this conflict escalating. Just little snippets of news footage and newspaper headlines. And it's very relatable. That's how we process these things. Like, we'd all just be at home occasionally getting a glimpse of just this endless cycle of retaliation and calling each other's bluffs, and there's nothing that you can do about it but sit back and start to prepare.
Well, that is interesting. Yeah, what you were talking about at the beginning, Sinead, about how at the root of this, the thesis is sort of based around the fact that there's so much denial in these communities. And that is like such a big part of both of these movies. And it's really intoxicating, like for a viewer almost. Like it's almost easy to get lulled into and go along with the narratives that they're just constantly beating each other, and the bullshit that their excuses are just like, oh no, if we just do X, Y, and Z and it'll be fine, it'll blow over, and all of this kind of stuff, which is always easy to do. That is like a big part of this movie, that we are just so buried. And that's one of the things I wonder about this movie, is like it's what it's saying about just how powerless we are,
yeah,
as a populace, or whether it's saying something else. I'm curious about that.
Well, you know, there's another kind of dimension that I think would be lost on a lot of people who don't live in either England or Ireland, is that Ruth and Jimmy, the couple from the film, they are from two kind of different worlds. That's set up at the start. Ruth is very much upper middle class and Jimmy is working class. His family is working class. And this is very much reflected in where they live. And it's where they live that actually impacts on their ability to survive the initial bombing, because Jimmy's family, they live in a council house, which is given to them by the government. I think it's a council house. It's never confirmed, but those are very, very small houses. They're quick builds. There's rows of them. They're always attached to another house. And in the protect and survive videos that they sent out to give people information on, you know, making your lean-to and putting your mattress in, and these are all the things that you need to put in your lean-to, they say you have to put all this stuff in a room that has no windows. In a two up, two down council house, there's no rooms that don't have windows. It's a very, very small, pokey little house.
Shit out of luck.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Ruth's family, they live in what looks like a Victorian build or maybe a Georgian build. So they've got a cellar, which means that their ability to actually survive the initial bombing is way, way higher. So all the working class people are basically shit out of luck.
Yeah, and that's basically what we see happen. Because anyone who hasn't seen this movie, we've talked about Jimmy and Ruth, and we get to know their families a little bit, and we stay with them for, you know, as long as they last in the movie. And really the only other plot line is following this guy who's kind of a peacetime minister who's, he's kind of called to this improvised, like, underground headquarters where, you know, the government is basically goes under this emergency transfer of power to set up these, like, regional governments around the country. And, you know, we don't get a lot of stuff with him. And this is, again, this is not like your typical scientist character or something like, okay, now this is going to be the person who we see on the other side of the government. We see how helpless that he ends up being too. But those are basically the characters that we cut back and forth between during this. And it starts out with their more personal concerns, you know, those two families that you mentioned from kind of different social classes meeting each other, and they get, you know, the couple gets a new apartment and Jimmy has this little fling with somebody else before they move in together while she's pregnant. But more and more, we start to zoom out a little bit and see these factoids about the population, the nearest military targets, and we start to see, you know, the food shortages, the fuel shortages, protests happening, evacuating hospitals.
Oh yeah, the protest is wild. It's so realistic and intense.
So realistic.
Yeah, and you know, what's funny about the protest is that kind of a little bit into it, somebody starts shouting at the person running the protest, saying that, you know, well, this is pointless. Why are you protesting this when everybody's unemployed? It's because Margaret Thatcher had been shutting down the plants, the places where everybody was working for quite some time there. And Sheffield was kind of like the epicenter of where this was happening. So unemployment was a huge problem in Sheffield, which had been known for its steel factories. And unfortunately, it's the steel factories probably made it a viable target military wise. And yet the steel factories had been shut down. So it's like, again, these people, they're not taking the actual danger into account. They're more concerned about the things that are first and foremost on their minds, and it's probably stopped them from making any kind of meaningful precautions when it did happen.
Yeah, and the way the movie specifically points out, like, here are the targets and, you know, naming places that probably would have been hit. And I want to give a shout out to the director. Is it Mick Jackson?
Yeah.
Yeah, Mick Jackson. Yes. He definitely put a ton of research into this, and the whole goal was to make this as factual as possible and talking to all kinds of experts. And I think that really comes out in all of the different things we see happening in the lead up to the attack. And he just has a really good eye for little moments that say a lot. I'm thinking like of when there are kind of riots happening outside, he cuts inside to this museum where they're taking down like paintings and art. Like, yeah, maybe we can save, you know, some of our culture, and it's all very quiet and mournful. Or when the couple is there in their apartment and, you know, they're crying and very worried about what's going on. They have nothing else to do, so they just keep stripping the wallpaper to go ahead with their renovation plans, even though that couldn't matter less at that point. Stuff like that stuck with me.
Yeah. I would like to talk a little bit actually about the Protect and Survive that I just mentioned there. Did you guys watch those videos? The ads that were on TV telling you this is where you need to build your fallout shelter. And this is what you need to do if somebody dies in your house. You cover them with plastic and then you drag them outside.
That was wild. So those were real? Like,
those were real, yes.
Going around?
Yeah, they were on TV. But the thing about them was that the information that was in them is completely useless. What it was made for is it was made to stop people from rioting in the streets and to give everybody a sense of control. So building, you know, taking the doors down so that you can build shelter, putting mattresses away, painting your windows, it's all just busy work. They were just trying to keep you busy.
Yeah, put you away. And then
the funny thing is we didn't get any of this information in Ireland. We were just basically left to fend for ourselves if anything happened. And that includes Northern Ireland. So, yeah.
I mean, it could just be the American in me, but there does seem to be a very particular, like, European sort of, I don't know, persona like that of
stiff upper lip,
sweetening something so awful, you know?
Yeah, no, it was very much a stiff upper lip attitude that had kind of seen them through World War II after the Blitz happened. I mean, people were very stoic and they were very proud of how stoic they were at the time. And I think the government wanted to try and keep that sense going. And that's why these films were made. It was made to keep people calm, give them a sense of purpose and, you know, keep them from rioting until right up until the moment when they got vaporized.
You know, in the U.S., our version of those PSAs, the one that people who lived through that will recall now, is the famous, you know, duck and cover drills, this like kind of absurd idea that school children ducking under their desks at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis or something could possibly protect them. We really just had these extremely robust, you know, massive budget propaganda efforts, you know, big Hollywood movies from this time. But I think it matters a lot to this movie's arc that like the people in it are not remotely like aggressors. Like that's the big difference is the U.S. is one of the main agitators in this conflict. And I think our cultural reflections of the time show that. And then these people, it's kind of just like taken for granted that they're part of NATO. So they're going to suffer the consequences of these actions by sovereign powers on opposite sides of the world fighting in Iran, like a totally like unrelated battlefield conflict.
I think that's exactly why I was hypothesizing that all these movies are British, except for The Day After. All these other ones we've been talking about are British films because I guess they were like just the ones stuck in the middle of it, right?
Well, I think in around that period of time, there was kind of just a general feeling of hopelessness that people had around certain circumstances. And there's one thing actually, when we're talking about the politicians in the bunker, I mean, are they even politicians as such? These are people that you could easily see having day jobs, maybe as a supermarket manager or something like that, and that they've run for local election, which doesn't give you an awful lot of power. It gives you the power to talk to other higher up politicians, but that's it.
Yeah, they describe them as being confused about their new roles or something like that. And they're still like, what am I doing? Wait, I'm the head of what now?
No, these are people that are your local headmaster, the manager of your local supermarket. You know, these are people who are useful in their own way and that they may have elements of leadership, but they've got no resources, they've got no information, and they have no idea what they're doing, and they can't cope at all when the shit does hit the fan and they lose all communication.
Yeah, and the shit does hit the fan.
Yes, spectacularly so.
Yeah, let's talk about that nuclear strike, because it does happen and it kind of catches you off guard a little bit, like they're in the middle of a conversation and the alarms start going off. And
yeah, it's about 50 minutes in or so.
Yeah,
minutes in,
just about. And yeah, I found this to be, I mean, pretty much everything is upsetting in this movie from this point on. But this particular really put me on my ass, because just the editing and the way that they use what couldn't have been a huge budget to depict such spectacular, horrifying destruction. And just like in the War Game, there's just bodies burning and buildings collapsing, and a lot of our main characters just unceremoniously die, like Jimmy.
Well, more on that later. But Jimmy runs off and we don't see him after that. So we don't really know what happens to Jimmy as such. Mm. We imagine that he's dead. But fun fact actually about the explosion is that that was actually a deserted part of Sheffield that was due for demolition. So the film crew got permission to go in there and basically blast it for real. Yeah, they were given free rein to do it. And they only could have done that because of the kind of urban deprivation that had been happening in that area. Because almost everybody was unemployed and nobody could afford to do any high street shopping anymore. So they were like, yeah, we have a deserted high street. You can blow it up if you want. And they did. And because it's a real explosion, like, you can't get an explosion that looks that real, even in special effects that we have now. You can't simulate that. Yeah,
that's what I wondered.
Listen, oh, I wouldn't put it past them to have said, yeah, we can't afford to have somebody make a fake corpse so that we can throw it into the fire. So we just borrowed a couple of real corpses from the morgue down the road. I don't think they did that, but I think... like, as far as special effects go for these people, I mean, those are very realistic looking corpses.
They are.
Incredibly realistic looking corpses.
And there's so many of them. Like, that's the big thing I can't stress enough that really is amazing about this movie and makes you question, like, what the budget could have been, is the coverage of, like, every aspect, whether it's the beginning of the movie setting up what Sheffield is and what every bit of this process getting to the nuclear explosion is, or even at the moment of the explosion. Every part of this process feels like you are just getting so much coverage, so many shots, so many different settings, so many different characters, and it really is amazing. And it becomes so immersive, and yeah, you see so much destruction in so many different ways, so many different families being destroyed. The one family that the mother is immediately like burned. They do at least have a lean-to up, which...
Yeah, that's Jimmy's parents.
Jimmy's parents, that's right.
Yeah, and their youngest son was out in the garden at the time because he got freaked out by the sirens and he went out to sit with the birds in the aviary and got the building dropped on him.
That's the last of him.
Yep.
Yeah, like all they have is this like door that's basically like set up against a wall for them to like huddle in while they are mourning... 5 minutes later, mourning their son, which, yeah, it's like hard for you not to put yourself in these situations. I think the facelessness of the characters, sort of like how they are, like there's too many characters for you to develop them in like organic, normal sort of ways. So they sort of, it's very easy to empathize with them and just sort of see a mother character and just put your own mother in that mother's place, or the father or the son or whoever it is. And it works very well.
Yeah. I mean, 20 minutes before that explosion happened, that woman was given out to her son for getting his girlfriend pregnant, which, you know, that's really humanizes her within about 5 seconds. So it is genuinely devastating to see just how useless the rules that they had been living by were in protecting them. You know, it's just like, it's an extra kind of little bit of salt in the wound.
Yeah. And those particular parents, like they survive, you know, for a little bit, but it is not fun. Like Seth was saying, the, you know, the mother has like part of like her face and hair burn off, and you can see their will to live slowly dwindling. And really the strike itself is kind of over relatively quickly. It's the aftermath of it that is just gets worse and worse and worse.
Yeah. And I mean, we have what is the our closest thing to a main character, the pregnant lady?
Ruth.
Ruth, yeah. And she is just like immediately distraught. And you know why? Like, cause she's just like holding her stomach and like knowing that Jimmy's probably dead. And they were just like painting an apartment building that they were like maybe going to move into. And she's just immediately just like, what the fuck? Like, I'm just going to give birth to a baby in this. Whatever life I have now has to exist in this setting now.
Yeah, and I mean, even after the initial blast, it gets so much worse because even though her family survived, her parents are killed by looters when she's out trying to get into the hospital.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's another particularly like offhand thing that's chilling for how casual it is because, yeah, they are locked up in the basement for a while with the grandma. And at some point we see them like dragging the grandma's body upstairs to take it away from them, probably following the instructions in their little leaflets.
Absolutely, yeah.
And later on, you know, at some point later in the movie, we just see these scavengers going through that house and they eventually get shot. And there's just this casual mention of their, oh yeah, there's two bodies in the basement. And that's just the last that we hear about them. And that's kind of the same with, I guess, how Jimmy just kind of disappears.
Yeah.
So I think the last time we see him is he's running through the street. So you probably assume that he didn't make it past the blast. But the way that they leave that up in the air and how most people would experience this as them just not never seeing or hearing of the people that they love again and having no way.
Right. We never know.
Mm-hmm. So ultimately, it's like most of this movie is in the fallout of the attack, screen time wise. And we see it unfold with these little time cards that first it's, you know, 2 days after the attack, 16 days after, 6 weeks, 10 months, and eventually 10 years. And it just goes, stretches out and out and out. And it really makes me feel like this is almost like a response to kind of post-apocalyptic movies that, I mean, you could see in the 70s too, like The Omega Man or
The Boy and His Dog.
Right, right. And there's a huge trend in Hollywood movies that's probably still not over, post-apocalyptic films, you know, whether it's like I Am Legend or The Book of Eli, all of these things that kind of make it seem like this romantic, exciting adventure. And there's
yes.
an aspect of wish fulfillment to it, right? That like, oh man, what if I had the whole, you know, town to myself and we just got together in little gangs and we walked through the ruins. And this totally drains any romanticism from that. It's all sickness and starvation and sorrow.
Yeah, and everybody looks very gross as well because there's no sanitation. Everybody's still wearing the clothes that they were wearing in the blast. I mean, it's not one of the kind of the very explored areas of these apocalyptic films. I always find that the kind of the refugees from the atomic blast, they always look suspiciously tidy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I appreciated that they made the characters look a mess, like a proper mess.
And miserable.
I do love that point about this. And it did get me thinking a lot about that idea of other science fiction and post-apocalyptic movies, which I've heard Jeff Vandermeer, a sci-fi writer that I like a lot, who wrote the Southern Reach trilogy and such, and he talks a lot about how there is such a trend in post-apocalyptic literature, especially right now, that is like almost like once the bomb drops, it's like now it's just like a fun time. It's like now the fantasy world starts, and now like we get to have swords and like it's this interesting scenario that occurs and we like eat up those books and media and stuff like that. And this is a good reminder of like, I don't know, it's dangerous to romanticize that stuff. And it is dangerous to assume that we're just going to be okay. Or we're just going to start over. Or we can just, yeah, like pull up our bootstraps, as they were saying, and just get through it.
I suppose one thing that I found, probably the thing that I like best about this, is I have a real interest in child psychology and in attachment theory. And I think this is a real key kind of underwritten thing in the film, that the children that are being raised in the aftermath, their parents are shell-shocked and don't speak to their children. And it's kind of, if you don't, if you raise your child but you don't speak to them or kind of just hang out with them as a person in the first 5 years of life, you are raising a feral child. And that's what we see in the aftermath. We see these children are absolutely feral. They can only speak in kind of parroted languages that they've heard from other people, and nobody's looking out for them.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. Once we get to where it's like 10 years down the line and Ruth does end up giving birth to her daughter, and it's not clear if there's something necessarily wrong with her because of the, radiation, because she doesn't speak much. And it is like they have this kind of slang, like primitive language that the younger people are speaking. And that was like almost the most, the further into the future you project, the more of kind of a science fiction, speculative thing is going on there. But it's hard to look at this movie as science fiction because this is something that, to an extent, has happened places and seems like it's still so possible. We're just a button push away still from this. So it does not seem like a fantasy.
Probably one of the most disturbing things I've seen in this movie. I'm sure it's just, a scene that went down in infamy when people saw it for the first time, with Ruth walking around through the ruins and she turns around and there's a woman with a bloody child, and she's just clutching the child like it's still alive or something.
Yeah, they show that shot twice. It's so haunting.
Yeah, she's clearly like has flashbacks with it.
Yeah.
That is like a reoccurring thing throughout this, that, childbirth and the or dead children, because of, I don't know if we want to get to the very end yet, but that is, it's sort of bookended by birth, and its climactic, horrible scene debatably is involving us seeing what could be the worst thing for us to see, which is a dead infant.
Yeah, it's like if we felt like we were spared because Ruth does end up giving birth to her daughter and she survives, into adolescence at least, and you think like, oh, phew, like she didn't lose the baby. Well, it still has something in store for you at the end as far as somebody. Yeah. Not that we even know that she's pregnant, that her daughter is pregnant, because at this point Ruth herself has died. Okay, since that is the very end, is there anything else just in that extended, part before that anyone wanted to bring up? Because I did want to touch on the hospital sequence where they open up a hospital, but it's basically just another ruin. It's hopelessly crowded, and there's basically no way to care for these people. They're all wailing and deformed, and their body parts are charred. And there's no painkillers or morphine to go around.
Renders the doctors useless.
Yeah, there's not even a point to it being a hospital yet. That's where they all still just kind of shamble out of instinct.
Yeah, I'd say that was probably the only part of the film that I found scary at all. Because I have a complex medical history myself, so I spent a lot of time in hospitals. And I think that's kind of the scene that would have hit me personally. And I think this film, it does kind of seem to go out of its way to get something that'll hit everybody personally. If it doesn't get you the first time, it'll get you on something else, kind of a way.
Well, for sure.
Yeah, it is brutal. And it leaves no stone unturned. It feels very painstaking and methodical and thorough. Like, there's nothing else you need to know.
Yeah, what's the fact that they throw out there where it's like only, it would take so many hospitals even to just begin to repair the damage to the patients in Sheffield, right?
Mm.
Let alone like one hospital in Sheffield. So it's just like moot point immediately. They can't help anyone.
There's an undercurrent to that as well, in that the doctors and the nurses who are treating these people are exposing themselves to very high levels of radiation just by doing their job. And I think that plays into the hospital that we see at the very end of the film, which is a makeshift hospital that somebody has set up in a public toilet and has one nurse in it that doesn't really care to actually help anybody, because all of the good doctors and the good nurses have been taken out by being exposed to high levels of radiation.
Yeah, she certainly doesn't have any problem with a baby being born, dead and covered in blood and then just handing it to the mother. And we basically get this freeze frame like right before she goes to scream while she's holding this child, and then it's the end.
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, well, I mentioned earlier about Jimmy and about how he disappears and we don't see him again. There is a man in the bed beside where Jane is giving birth, and his face is very heavily scarred, but he bears a very similar resemblance to an older Jimmy.
Oh, wow.
So there's a theory that that is actually her dad, but he's shell-shocked and just insane.
Oh, God.
Wow, yeah. That's not any happier than him dying.
No, he's there, though. He made it to the birth.
I like to make things worse.
Granddaughter, yeah. That is worse. Yeah, I mean, I didn't know how I felt about that ending. It really hits hard as far as like maybe going a little too far into just like gross out, like scaremongering. Like maybe it's the fact that it's a freeze frame or something. I mean, I like it as like a total oddity for ending this movie, but yeah, I don't know. Do you think it maybe like overplays its hand, or?
I mean, I think that it's a bit worse. Like, it actually would be worse if the baby survived, because can you imagine this 13-year-old girl who's completely feral herself trying to raise this baby?
Well, yeah, there leaves no room for hope in any scenario in this.
I was thinking about the whole time, I was like, what point am I going to just kill myself?
Watching it or in the movie?
In the movie, like, if I was a character in the movie, I'm just like wondering, like, what point am I just going to like stop caring and just like, I can't do this anymore?
That's a good question. And I think that, you know, if I were going to critique the film, it's just that overall it is extremely narrow-minded, that it has one goal and one goal only, which is to show you how it'll be hell on earth if this happens. And in that way, it's like the most powerful kind of cautionary tale that you could possibly have that does maybe limit the dramatic possibilities just because it is so just hammering that note of despair in. So it's almost like it, in accomplishing its goal of being this, the most harrowing like PSA ever made, it does leave you with like almost an overload of things. Another thing is that as it goes on, it does seem to get a little more fragmented, like the segments get shorter and shorter, like it's just covering all its bases of getting from, you know, one atrocity to the next. And sometimes at that point was when the voiceover maybe took me out of the like action a little bit, or was reminding me more that it's a movie. I know there was something about that happening in the latter half as opposed to the early half when it's still this like ticking time bomb that, I don't know, maybe takes away a little bit from the actual drama or action going on.
Yeah. Do you know, I kind of, what I see it as is the first half of the film, these are complex human beings with complex storylines. When you get to the very end of the film, these are no longer complex human beings. They have one-track minds, they have low attention spans, and they have limited vocabulary. So your attention is shortened to the length of their attention, almost. Is what I see. Towards the end of the film, there's a little game that I like to play when I rewatch it, which is, I call it Surprise Corpses, because there's always new corpses every time I watch it, and I never pick up on them the first time. So it's just all, oh, there's a corpse. That wasn't there before. So I don't know. Maybe I'm watching this film wrong.
That would definitely happen to me, because I was definitely doing, covering my eyes every once in a while.
Yeah, this is one of the more ruthless movies we've watched, I think.
Yeah.
It definitely left me in kind of a bad place afterwards. We do like to ask at the end of every film discussion is, if you could, would you unwatch this movie? But it sounds like, Sinead, that would erase like half your life, wouldn't it?
Well, do you know, I would actually say that I would unwatch it so that I can go back and watch it for the first time again. Yeah. Like, I don't know. I just find this a really fun romp. So, and I always watch this with kind of new eyes whenever I go to it, and pick up different things every time I do watch it. So I, like, as a connoisseur of the depressive, that's just like, it's the apex of the films that I've watched. So no, I would not unwatch this.
I wouldn't either. I'm incredibly impressed by its scope. I really adore an ensemble, like wide roaming. It's like Nashville, but on fire. You know, it's very exciting. There's so much happening.
Yeah.
I was really impressed. Not on watching.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with Seth. This was a very, very effective movie, especially for all the things that it's not. So as far as disaster films go, this is like stripped down to the starkest, bleakest, bare bones of it that you could get to. And if you don't like that, this same director apparently directed Volcano with Tommy Lee Jones. And you can always hop onto that disaster movie ride to cleanse your palate.
It's the polar opposite. Jesus.
He also did The Bodyguard, too. Interesting career for Mick Jackson.
Yeah. Wild.
I think maybe there's something about Threads to just put him off doing films like that for a while. And he tried to kind of go very, very Hollywood in the aftermath.
Yeah, let's make people being burned fun again, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Please. Yeah, I mean, where do you go anyways after a movie like that? He's already ended the world, so you couldn't get any more brutal than that.
Well, now it's all dousing lava with cement bags and water.
Right. Yeah.
Because pyroclastic flow is not a thing, apparently.
No.
Well, man, if only Tommy Lee Jones had been there for Threads, he would have found some way to stop those bombs.
That's a good point.
And he might have saved the couple in our next movie. I would love him to just like burst through the window and grab these two old couple and just swing on a line. I gotcha. Don't worry. And where the wind blows, that's it. Roger Waters starts singing. Movie's over.
Just 2 years later, we get another one of these movies with When the Wind Blows in 1986. But wildly different approach and very complimentary.
We zoom in. No more ensemble. Just two characters in the whole movie.
Absolutely. And apparently it was based on a graphic novel by Raymond Briggs from 1982. And even before the movie came out, it was adapted as a BBC radio drama and a stage production. So this is such an intimate single location film, as opposed to the sprawl of Threads, that all you really need are these two people and they could just vocally act it out.
But they're not people. They're animated. They're just little cartoon people.
Well, they are based on Raymond Briggs' parents.
Aww.
Well, and that you can tell with the specificity of these characters, too.
And he killed them.
Yeah, and he's a mean bastard, man, what he puts them through.
Spoiler.
I feel like the snowman should have really been like an advance warning to us, given the ending of that.
So is that the same animator or the same writer?
It's the same animation studio, and they also did a film about Father Christmas taking a holiday. So he was very known for kind of family-friendly entertainment at that point.
That is how this looks, and that's what like really drew me in. It was a very nostalgic feel to it. I always remember crying to the snowman. Now I cry to this.
Yeah. So this is directed by Jimmy Murakami, and it's a very simple story for anyone who hasn't seen it. It just follows this one old couple who is living somewhere in the countryside, which is Jim, played by John Mills, and Hilda, who's voiced by Peggy Ashcroft. And, you know, they're an older couple who lives alone. They, you know, he speaks with his son on the phone at one point, but you don't even hear his voice. And he is in, you know, this couple is preparing for the nuclear war that is about to come out. And a huge part of this movie is these pamphlets that are glimpsed in Threads and that we were speaking about earlier. And the way that the husband of the couple is trying to do everything by the book, that he's going to follow all the instructions, they're going to do their duty and make it through this turmoil. And you can probably, you know, sense from the beginning that that's not how it's going to play out. And we just stick with them to the bitter end.
I think the whole thing with the pamphlets, I mean, this is where we really get to see them go into detail about basically how useless this stuff is. And I mean, you said Jim and Hilda are preparing for the thing. Well, Hilda's not. Jim is doing all the work. Hilda's kind of giving out to him every now and then for messing up the house.
Right.
That's about the standard of reaction that you kind of expect from most people when they were reading these pamphlets.
Right.
Yeah. And as it turns out, neither one of them was, either approach would have led to the same result.
Exactly.
Yeah, really. I love how the nuclear disaster is approached, basically. Jim sort of just walks in the room at the beginning of the movie, and, you know, Hilda's just making tea and washing dishes, and they are just having a conversation, and he just sort of slips in here and there that, like, well, there might be something happening today. I don't know. There might be a little something. I'm looking at this pamphlet. And then it slowly snowballs, and he's, like, adding more. And that's kind of how, like, the trajectory of the movie is just his denial and his sort of trying to pad the free fall for Hilda out of love and also just out of his own self-preservation, because he doesn't want like a panicked situation on his hands. He just keeps on doing that until it's obvious that it's just the worst situation it has happened.
Yeah, and those the particular pamphlets are just like Sinead brought up, that I was reading about the Protect and Survive. Basically, it was a whole public information campaign, but they do specifically read things out of that leaflet, like using the doors as the lean-to and the box of sand for dishwashing. Like, that's all directly from that pamphlet, which actually was dispensed in 1980. They were still putting these things out, you know, all these years later.
Yeah, and Hilda's kind of, her approach to the guidelines, she's massively offended by about half of them. And like the whole thing about going into the shelter, she's all like, well, what if families have children? Are they all expected to fit in this shelter? I'm not washing my dishes in a bucket of sand. I'm going to wash it at the sink like a proper person. I think somebody once described her as a real Women's Institute type, which is it's almost like a real archetype of British women that are very, very proper no matter what the circumstances are. And that was kind of a very popular attitude during World War II, because it was a real pull yourself up by your britches and just get on with it kind of thing.
Which World War II is brought up in this a lot. That's what they keep on talking about. They keep on saying like, oh, those Nazis are going to drop the bomb. I mean, the Ruskies are going to drop the bomb. And they keep on just like pontificating and being nostalgic about World War II, of all things, like it was a beautiful time in their lives, and that this is just going to be another one of those. And we got through that, and that was fine. And we'll get through this one. It's going to be easy, you know, just like the Blitz. Remember the Blitz? No problem.
I don't think they would have gotten the worst of the Blitz because, I mean, the countryside, as far as it looks to me, that looks like Yorkshire. And they would have been kind of out in the countryside, so they wouldn't have had as many bombs dropped on them as London. So I'd say, yeah, I mean, the Anderson shelter at the time, they were kitted out with comic books and chocolate and all sorts of things. So for kids at the time, it would have actually been kind of exciting to go into the Anderson shelter and just hang out there. It'd be like going on a camping trip. So that's why they're not taking it that seriously.
Sure. And I think a big theme of the movie is just that they are nostalgic for a war where there seemed, even if it was an illusion, to have clarity, where they knew their role they played in it. They knew who the two sides were. And this new kind of war, they comment that, like, well, we don't even know who the people are these days. It must just be committees who are running everything. Or
yeah,
afterwards, they're like, I wonder who won, as if this was something that could be won. And they're both so concerned. Well, you know, like you said, that Hilda is kind of this example of a woman raised on the values that came out of that time period. And so is Jim, that he is concerned about doing the correct thing and being called into public service, and that there's a way that they, if they just follow the rules, they can get through this. And they're even nostalgic about, you know, Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill in this great, like, stylized scene that shows each of them. And then, you know, it goes down to Hitler and Mussolini. Like, we know that these were the bad guys, and we were on this side. They were on that side. Those were the days.
Right.
And that's all out the window now. This is a totally new kind of war.
Which, even outside of the nuclear context, you can bring this into any situation involving government and involving these simple narratives, which are getting in the way of the truth, which is just constantly having this denial, again, that is easy to get swept up in. And with these characters and be like, you know what? I bet he's doing the correct thing, quote unquote, as he keeps on saying. I bet they're going to be fine. You know, he put up the door. You know, that's fine. Oh, yeah, yeah. But it's it becomes a shield for the truth that is too painful to look at.
Yeah, they're very childish adults in a way. You know, their approach to almost everything is quite childish. Like, there's the whole thing with Jim, whenever he's talking about the shelter, he calls it the inner core or refuge. He never calls it the inner core or the inner refuge. It's always the inner core or refuge.
Because that's the correct thing.
Exactly.
I found it very disturbing, the initial phone call before the blast happens. It's a creepy bit of foreshadowing when they call their son. They said that, like, he seems like he's drunk and he's not, like, listening to his dad about, like, what's going on. I kind of interpreted it as, like, maybe they're just, like, kind of going out in a blaze of glory or something over there. They're, like, they're not going to listen to the pamphlet. They know they're going to die. Like, they're just getting shit-faced out there, like, because literally tomorrow we die. I was wondering if that's what was going on there.
He was singing, actually. He was singing a marching song, "We'll All Go Together When We Go."
Oh, right.
Yeah, I think he was just taking the piss out of his dad, the way a lot of people take the piss out of their dad, the way I take the piss out of my dad.
Yeah, and we never leave the house at all, besides him, like, riding a bus home in the very first scene. So we never get a follow-up or any kind of view about what's going on in the cities or with his son. It's all contained, and you really feel that claustrophobia and just how, again, helpless you would be in that situation and completely alone. They never run into anybody else. And I feel like it is realistic in that way, if something like that were to happen, where there's no, you know, the TV never miraculously turns on to let them know what's happening around the world. As soon as that bomb goes off, they're just in this wasteland all the way to the end. And it's a sad, slow journey to the inevitable for these two. There's no hero in this one either.
For that reason, I mean, I found this to be a more disturbing, more difficult watch than Threads, because it was just, it seems like that's actually how it would be to experience as a singular person. You wouldn't have this, you know, it's hard to classify the sweeping shots of gore and, like, ensemble suffering like a respite in Threads, but at the same time it does give you this sort of, like, camaraderie, this feeling of, like, okay, well, yeah, like, I'm suffering, but we're all in it together. Like, everybody's in this movie is together, and it's a wider net. Here it is, like, it's closer to the truth that we would be just sort of locked up, probably, like, dying with our significant other, like, watching our significant other slowly pass away and knowing what's coming. That would be just, I just found that so hard to stomach.
This does appeal more to the level of emotions, for sure, because it's a much more personal story. And I think it allows it to tease out some, you know, more themes than the Threads it really is able to, as far as the old, you know, the old ways of doing things and the role of the government and stuff like that. Although in a way it is just as, like, laser focused on the dwindling fate of two people that we care about.
Yeah, I think these people they're more likable than the ones from Threads. They're less realistic, but more likable.
Yeah, I could agree with that. I do think, yeah, every once in a while, maybe they're, like, almost too simplistic.
Yeah.
At a certain point, I was just really waiting for them to just kind of have a moment together, or, like, have some sort of real back and forth, real conversation of, like, saying how much they love each other or something. It doesn't have to be, like, this big speech or anything. But at the same time, we do get these dream sequences that I think explore that a little bit. They're, like, inner lives and their pasts. There are these, like, weird, I think there's two or three of them, and they're beautiful, like, weird dream sequences that show, like, sort of flashbacks and fantasies. It shows Hilda, like, as a fairy or something at some point, like, swimming through a beautiful garden, flying through the air and stuff like that. And it shows them getting married and everything's, like, It's a beautiful piece of animation.
It really is. I do think that it's not a very British thing, especially kind of an old-fashioned British thing to make great declarations of love and passion. But I think kind of one scene that you really do get an idea of how much this couple loves each other is when the bomb is about to drop and Hilda says she's going to take the cake out of the oven. And he calls her a stupid bitch and tells her to get into the shelter. And she's mortally offended by him swearing at her because he never swears at her. I think that's kind of a look into what their real dynamic is, that he's never said a bad word to her in his life, but he's doing it now. That's also to hammer home how serious this is as well.
Mm-hmm. He really wants to save her.
Yeah, and to protect her.
Yeah.
And you're right. They never reckon with the fact that they're going to die all the way to the last scene where they decide, you know, well, maybe we should pray. And he just kind of prays into the night as he's forgetting even how to pray and is starting to quote completely different, you know, sources. It's like all the way to the end, it's ending in confusion for them, that they never fully process that things are different now and there is no help coming and nobody has won this war. And they ride that all the way to the end, basically. Although, you know, Seth, you bringing up those dream sequences is a good way to talk about just the animation, because such a huge thing about this is the medium that it's told in. And I think it's fundamentally a work of animation because it comes from a graphic novel and it really looks great because it combines traditional animation with stop motion, which it took me a little while to figure out, like, wow, all these different points, the textures look so different. Like we're looking at a model or something in the background. And apparently it was because they were combining these two things. And so there's these just cool, like, panoramic shots that kind of like reveal different dimensions in the backgrounds. And they even use live action footage very judiciously throughout.
There's real sets. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there was a thing that the old Fleischer Studios, the people who made Betty Boop, they used to do something very similar to get a real sense of perspective. They used to build like a miniature set and then have the animated characters move through it. But I think partially this was also done because the set was something that could be destroyed physically in a way that you couldn't necessarily, if you drew the destruction in the way that they drew the characters, it wouldn't be as effective as actually building a set and then detonating it.
Sure.
Which that's fascinating. It's just like, not choosing one or the other. It's choosing which one is going to actually give the gravitas, actually get through to the audience better, and going the length to do it.
And then when we get the actual explosion, it switches to at least what kind of looks like charcoal, like drawings to me. So each little sequence has its own little approach. So we have that kind of sketchy charcoal look for that. At one point, we get kind of a montage of stills of them as a young couple and their courtship and, you know, getting older together, which kind of unexpectedly happens, like right after the explosion, and is placed in a very, you know, dynamic like spot to suddenly be showing us that stuff. And I really like the variation. Other parts that look like almost there was like watercolors. I think they might have used that in those dream sequences that Seth was talking about, or whatever those sequences are. They're not even really explained. It's like she just blows onto a dandelion and suddenly these visions of her flying with the butterflies and a prince and a princess, or like her mother and father rising from their grave and flying into the air. And the way that they don't explain or contextualize those little things, I think make them very effective in this context.
Those other aspects of the animation are fascinating. But I think it's almost more fascinating that the majority of the film is just very straight and very, it's just two animated characters having long conversations, which you don't see a lot in animation very often. And it's a bold move to, you'd almost think that most of this could just be a stage play. It could just be very easy to just have like two characters in a room. There it is. But you're adding on all this extra work to make a animated conversation, an animated version of these back and forths, which is a very great argument for the legitimacy of how animation can be used in a regular adult feature, which we just talked about, Plague Dogs, which I think is like another sort of middle ground that didn't necessarily work. And we didn't get a lot of adult animated features that are just like serious films rather than like exploitation or just like what the fuck, man, sort of animation stuff. It's still either just that or Pixar. This is definitely in that interesting middle ground where people were really being serious. They want to make animated features, which you just don't see dialogue exchanges like this very often in animation.
I do feel like that's kind of a uniquely British thing, because that's been a feature in some other British films as well in animation, that there's a lot of kind of long dialogue tracks like that. Because I think something similar happened in sections of Watership Down. I haven't seen The Plague Dogs for quite a while, but, you know, I think that's there's more dialogue in a British animated film than there would be, I think, in a standard American one.
And more dialogue without, like, they're talking and then all of a sudden, like, well, we better show what they're saying because it's animation and we better make the eye dance around and stuff like that. They don't really feel the need to do that in this.
Yeah, I think as well, a lot of the animation studios in England are quite small. So, I mean, having two characters talk for a long time really saves on your budget.
Practical.
I can't imagine this being nearly as effective as a radio play or a stage piece. So much of the texture of it and the impact of it comes from the style for me. I feel like so much would be lost if you just narrowed it down to this just being two regular old people walking around a room talking to each other and slowly dying.
Yeah.
That would be almost too of a one-track experience for me.
Even the Charlie Brown sort of style is like subliminally fucking with me, that I'm just like, well, it's something bad can't happen here. They look like little animated Charlie Browns. They're going to be fine.
I do think that there's some things that just work better in animation than in live action. I think there's some things you can't do them in live action for whatever reason. And there's some things as well you can only do in 2D animation that just doesn't work in 3D.
Yeah, imagine Plague Dogs either in live action or in a, you know, Pixar style, like photorealistic. Oh. You know, dogs running around. It's just, you'd lose the whole soul of it.
I suppose as well, like, it's a really common thing for 2D animated films is this film has aged incredibly well. You know, it looks as vibrant as it did when it was first made.
Absolutely. This kind of animation does not age. Even if you look at, like, the first Toy Story now, it's this weird, like, blurry graphic computer animation. And when you do something that's just, you know, art like this, it'll just last forever and it's timeless. This way, it's an experience that happens, you know, partly in your mind as opposed to just on the screen. It's not totally literal. It has this kind of fantastical, emotional layer to it.
And a David Bowie song.
Yes, we can't not talk about the David Bowie theme song, like title track, which I actually knew this song and had no idea that it came from this movie.
Oh.
Yes, there you go.
And not only that, we got Genesis, we got Roger Waters, who's a you know, you see in a lot of the Pink Floyd stuff. He has, you know, nuclear concerns, right?
Oh yeah, so much of this struck me as just like something that fell off the wall and became a whole feature.
I wonder, did anybody actually tell these guys what the film was about before they recorded the song?
That's a great question.
That's how those always feel. Like, so many of these, like, songs, it just feels like they're just like, we're still working on the script a little bit, but there's wind, there's a bomb, there's some love. Go nuts.
Yeah, and if the animation hasn't aged at all, these songs are so tied to the 80s and production techniques and gated drums that, yeah, I would definitely, if I could, take out any of the like 80s pop music that this starts out with. It's mainly at the, I guess, the beginning, and I don't mind the Roger Waters song over the end credits, but
that seems to fit. Yeah, Bowie's song is cute, but not in the context. of the movie, I feel like. It doesn't really fit.
Yeah, I think maybe him and Raymond Briggs were just like friends. And because he worked on The Snowman, he wanted to work on this as well. And they just didn't have the heart to tell him what it was about.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it was the worst just phase of Bowie's career that they could have gotten him to do a song for this movie, too. Because all of his records at that time were these big commercial, you know, 80s synth pop records. Just not what you want for this movie. But, you know, who wants to turn down a David Bowie song to stick on your movie? Maybe it got them some more, I don't know, clout or money or something.
That is the bummer. Same with Labyrinth, right? It seems like once you're able to get Bowie in your movie, he's in this period and he's going to write some low-key kind of bad songs for you.
Like, I just have this I have this mental image of him in the trench coat from the Dancing in the Street video, just like bopping his way across the ruins of Jim and the Ildis house.
I would not mind seeing that, actually. All right, well, any final thoughts about When the Wind Blows? Another bummer to end us with, but that fits in neatly with this whole theme.
Which one do you guys think is the more bummer movie? I'm curious.
Definitely Threads.
Okay.
I don't get the same depression kick out of When the Wind Blows as I do with Threads, so I don't watch it as often. And I watch Threads on a fairly regular basis, you know. Sometimes it's just on in the background while I'm painting and stuff. So it's, you know, I think that's the more depressing film because it's so relentlessly bleak. At least with in when the Wind Blows, you get Jim and Hilda just kind of hanging out and eating sausages and making cakes for the first little while. It's very hopeful at the start.
Yeah, I guess it depends, you know, which bothers you more, if because you get more of a sense of this really wistful melancholy from When the Wind Blows, whereas Threads is like a harrowing experience in a very violent kind of way. So it's hard for me to compare them in that way, or to say, because I mean they're both bummers. Threads like disturbed me more.
Yes, more visually, like visceral for sure.
Yeah, and if you're scared of nuclear war, it'll probably get under your skin more. But emotionally, I could definitely see When the Wind Blows being something that would make you cry.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's really difficult to play Find the Corpse in When the Wind Blows because there's only two. maybe three if you count the cat.
True.
So, you know, so I think Threads wins on that count at the very least.
And at least
I think,
on that count, yes.
Yeah, and I think Threads is more existentially terrifying and disturbing than When the Wind Blows is. When the Wind Blows sort of does cushion its hit a little bit, I think.
Yeah. I guess I just go back to I feel cushioned by the like sweeping nature of like there being a like ensemble, it being like Armageddon Magnolia or something, being like we are all in it together or something like that. And it is like more visually visceral and like exciting in this horrible way or something. Where yeah, Wind Blows is just like, oh man, inevitable death with my partner, and it's just real, it's just so sad to me. Long, slow sadness.
No.
Yeah, I think I was more disturbed by Threads for all the same reasons. I think in a lot of these kinds of movies, we have this tendency to expect there to be some persistence of the human spirit or whatever, and all of that goes out the window as soon as you know, the actual missiles hit. And at least in When the Wind Blows, there is one line from Hilda that I think is a glimmer of hope in these bleak films. So I want to make sure it makes it into the podcast. And that is when she says on the first night they're going to bed after the attack, bomb or no bomb, Hitler or no Hitler, I'm going to go to the toilet in the proper manner.
Hell yeah.
That's the spirit.
Well, she has her priorities straight.
Yeah, you pretty much decide whatever priorities you want when you get to the end of the world.
So yeah, I wouldn't unwatch this one, but I am way further from rewatching it than I am Threads. I do think I could have a fun paint session with Threads. That does sound kind of fun.
Yeah, it is pretty fun. I would highly recommend it. It's very relaxing.
I'm coming over. see you in a couple of
days. Fair enough. I'll put the kettle on.
Yeah, there is at least a sense of excitement it to parts of Threads because it does have that disaster movie structure. And there's definitely none of that that you could get from When the Wind Blows. But yeah, definitely not going to unwatch this one either, especially as an animated film. This is a really good one that I was thinking a lot about our animated episode that we did just, you know, previously to this, that this would have fit in really well with that too, just on the level of how it brings out all of these different layers and things just simply through the form that it takes.
Yeah, well, I have to say, I would not unwatch this film, but I'm going to level with you. There has only ever been one film that I have seen in my life that I would genuinely consider unwatchable. And I'm not even going to tell you what it is because I don't think anybody should watch it.
Whoa.
Oh, boy. Well, tickle my ass with a feather. Now, I gotta know.
You got Mark to say tickle my ass with a feather.
I mean, is it a movie like Cats or something that you really would just be a waste of your time or something that actually rattled your soul?
It rattled my soul,
and
it's not hyperbole for me to say that it is a genuine crime on camera.
Some Irish snuff we don't know about.
Remember to subscribe to our Patreon so you can hear the 10-second bonus episode we're going to post where Sinead reveals the most unwatchable movie she's ever seen.
Yeah.
Patreon.com/unwatchables.
You got to pay for this content.
Bedknobs and broomsticks. It's bedknobs and broomsticks.
Okay, no, I may take this secret to my grave.
Oh, man. Well, we'll come across it eventually. That'll be the goal of this podcast. Just let us know once we've hit it.
Let us know if we're getting warmer.
Well, Sinead, thank you so much for joining us. You were the perfect guest for this topic.
Wonderful ideas.
Do you want to plug, your, you know, podcast or anything else out there?
Well, the podcast has gone into a kind of retirement right now, but anybody that wants to check it out, just look for Crackpot Theories anywhere that you find good podcasts, bad podcasts, and my podcast. It's on Spotify and all the usual places. And if you want to, you can see me do fun things with puppets on TikTok under the name Fizzy Gnomes.
Ooh, buried the lead there.
All right. We could have done this whole thing. This whole thing you could have done with a puppet.
Oh, man.
Instead of just having the camera off.
I could have, but maybe you'll call me back for when you do like the Czech puppet films of Jan Švankmajer, which are very much unwatchable.
Oh, those are so crazy. I love those.
Maybe Meet the Feebles.
Ooh, yes, absolutely. I love Meet the Feebles.
That's on the list.
Yeah, I could take up a lot of your time here. I think I'd better sign off before this episode turns into a 4-hour long thing about things that Sinead likes.
Oh, Tony will cut it down to something real snappy and something we can sell.
Oh yeah, we'll get the bleakness across on this one real efficiently, and we will also link to your podcast and to your puppet TikTok in the episode description.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I'm after having an absolutely great time. I feel like I can die happy because somebody let me talk about Threads and how much I love it.
Oh yeah, it was, for lack of a better word, a blast.
I made that joke first earlier today. Okay, Mark stole that from me.
Yeah, but you gotta sell it. You gotta sell it. It's all in the heart. Unwatchables is produced by Tony Scarpitti. Hosted by me, Mark D'Ottavio, and Seth Troyer, with artwork by Micah Kraus. You can find Seth and I on Letterboxd under Mark D'Ottavio and Sloth Troyer. You can also check us out at unwatchablespod.com for links to our Twitter and Instagram, or support us on Patreon for bonus content and to have a say in what we watch. Thanks for listening. When the wind blows, when the wind blows.